This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. And the weather is absolutely delightful again, but we are back to our Florida weather, and sorry for all you people up north. I'm not laughing. All I know is I could never do it again. But I am so happy to be here in the studio. I'm not snowed out. I'm right here. And I have a wonderful guest today. You know, I don't know how many lawyers I get on this program. When I started this program, I thought I was just going to be talking to writers. But it turns out, like, I think 50% of the great writers are lawyers. So I am so happy to welcome to Joy on Paper, Steve Barry, and we are going to be talking about his wonderful new book, The Kaiser's Web. Hi, Steve.
How are you doing? Great for having me.
Okay. As I said, it looks like being a lawyer is great training for being a great writer, because you're terrific.
Well, thank you.
And this is the 16th book. Wow.
This is the 16th Cotton Malone book, my 20th novel. Yeah. So this is my 20th published book, so it's kind of a little milestone for me.
Wow. And I didn't check your website. Do you have, like, a counter on there that, you know, counts every second a book is sold?
Well, they did some statistics a little while back, and they determined that from September of 2003, which is when The Amber Room was published, up until right now, every 30 seconds for every day since then, somewhere in the world, a Steve Barry book was sold, which is pretty cool.
It is pretty cool. I can tell you, it is definitely cool. It's wonderful. It's amazing. Wow. Did you ever imagine that you would be selling, you know, 20 million, 25 million books?
No, I never gave that a thought, to be honest with you. I just wanted to publish the first one, and then I just wanted to publish the second one, and then the third. I just took them one at a time. I never really thought about where this would go, but now here we are 18 years later, 20 books later, and, you know, we're in 52 countries around the world. It's you have to pinch yourself sometimes.
Well,
it's quite amazing.
And they are all, well, they're all great books, and of course, the one that, you know, everybody, the series that everybody loves is the Cotton Malone series. You've taken Cotton Malone all over the world with adventures, and in this book it's no different. The Kaiser's Web takes him every place, and I was really thrilled when I read it, because I love history, like you. I love history, and I think to learn history from novels is so much fun, because nowadays, of course, as you're reading, if you want to, you know more about a subject, you can then go and do some research. But you've done so much research for the reader, and you lay it out so nicely. It's just really a thrill to read your books.
Well, thank you. I use around 300 to 400 sources, and those are all books. I use actual real books. I have a little bit of ebook, but mostly real books, because I need an index, and the ebook indexes are useless. So I use around 300 to 400 sources to write each novel, and I try to get it right. If I make mistakes, I do, but I give it my best shot to get it as close to reality as I can.
Well, tell us about The Kaiser's Web and how you got the idea, and what you want to tell people about this particular book.
Well, I was researching another novel about 4 years ago, and I just stumbled onto something that emanates out of World War II, something that happened in late 1944, and I didn't know it. I didn't know if it was real or not, so I did some more research on it. Sure enough, it actually was real, and so the novel sort of sprang from that little germ of something from the past. I don't want to say what it is, because it will give away some of the novel. I'd rather that be a surprise. It also deals with what happened on the night of April 30th, 1945, in the Führer bunker under Berlin. Now, this is not a novel about Hitler surviving the war and creating a Fourth Reich and all that. This is not that at all. But it is a novel about another person who was in the bunker that night, who disappeared and has never been seen since, and that's Martin Bormann. He was a fascinating character. And Bormann's the one who put something in place in late 1944, something that carries over even to today. And so all of this is going to play out across an election for the Chancellor of Germany. And it's a modern-day thriller with the Chancellor of Germany being selected, and there are secrets between these two candidates, secrets that emanate all the way back, and Cotton Malone gets caught up in that and ends up in an adventure that takes him to South Africa, to South America, to Switzerland, and then back into Germany. It's a fun adventure. It's an interesting. It's something from World War II that has not been dealt with very much, and I think it will surprise the reader.
I think so, too. There are lots of great surprises and lots of thrills. I particularly love, I don't know if you're a pilot, but I have flown in the GA-8 air van. My husband was a pilot, and so we flew in a lot of different airplanes over the years. And so when I'm reading that section, I won't tell people what it's about, but I did say, "Woo, that was quite a ride for me."
It was a ride, and Cotton, of course, is a pilot, and like Zippa Cassiopeia, who's with him, does not like it, and so they have to deal with something very immediate.
Well, we don't want to give away too much, but it was. I love that part. As a matter of fact, I went back and reread that section because that gave me a kick. It reminded me because I lived in England for a long time, and my husband was a pilot, and so we would fly quite often across. We would go across, the Channel and fly over Germany, fly over France, and so in those days we couldn't fly over Poland. Things were still not good, but we definitely did. And so one time we actually with a friend went in the air van. So it's really a great scene. I loved it.
Thank you. And people can, if they want to read that scene and get a taste for the book, they can go to my website, steveberry.org, and click on the Kaiser's Web. That excerpt that you just mentioned is there that people can read because it's chapter one of the novel.
Yeah, they should, and then they'll want to get the book to find out what happens to these characters. And of course, for all the books that you've had, Cotton Malone. Tell us a little bit about him in general. How did you come out with his persona?
He was born in Copenhagen in 2002. I was there basically on vacation, and that's when I found out that the Amber Room had been sold to Random House, and I was going to finally be a published writer, which was kind of neat. And he was born one evening. I was sitting in Hybro Plots, which is a square there, in the Café Nordon, and I was... it was a lovely evening. The windows were open. It was wonderful. And he just sort of popped in my head. I said, well, he's going to live right here. He's going to have a bookshop right over there. He's going to be a retired Justice Department agent who has moved to Copenhagen and gets himself into trouble all the time. And that's how the Templar Legacy was born. I came back home and I wrote the Templar Legacy, which was published a few years later. And now here we are 16 books later. But the reader shouldn't be put off by the fact there's 16 books. I write them where you do not have to read them in any order. You can pick them up in any sequence you want. They kind of stand by themselves, though they are a series, and there's no requirement that you had to read the one before. So find what part of history interests you, because each book deals with something different in history, and start there.
Exactly. Well, and I should mention that the Templar Legacy was voted one of the top 100 thrillers ever written. So that's a pretty great honor.
Well, that was kind of neat. NPR did that a few years ago, which was kind of surprised me a little bit. It's pretty neat. That remains, interestingly, still my biggest selling book of all is The Templar Legacy, which was published about 15 years ago.
Well, it's understandable because it is really great. And by the way, Amber Room is also a great book, and so many people don't know the story of it. And I think that Well, that's the fun thing about your books. There's history for every sort of every mood that you're in. You might want this or that or that, and you don't have to read them in order and just pick them up as sort of the mood strikes you of as you look at people. Look at the list of the different titles, and I love the titles. You have like among the best titles. Your books always have great titles. And
thank you.
So
I learned that from Robert Ludlum. Those are kind of Ludlum-esque titles, and we spend a lot of time to create the title and try to come up with a new word that we put in there, you know, like Charlemagne or Paris or Templars or Malta, something like that. And then the third word is usually the so what word, the word that makes something relevant today. So in this one, this one's what we call a noun title, the Kaiser's Web. So it's actually a noun. It's a thing. And so occasionally we have those as opposed to action titles. So we spend a lot of writers need to pay attention to that. What you titled your work really does matter, and you've got to pay really close attention to it.
It does. It's funny. So many writers, it's almost like a throwaway. Like I'll give it this title. But the fact is, because your titles are so memorable, the minute one sees them, or you remember them, and that's important.
And it needs to be relevant to the book. Another thing writers will do is they try to get too cute with the title. And I was guilty of that in the beginning, and I got taught a lesson. I had originally called my second book The Fourth Rome, which was a very clever, cutesy title. And when you read the novel, it makes perfect sense. The problem is it's not a book about Rome. It's a book about Russia. And so my editor, Mark Tavani, taught me a lesson. He said, no, this book is going to be The Romanov Something. So it became The Romanov Prophecy. And that's exactly what's relevant. That's a much better title. It's right on point. It's not cute. It's right to it. But it also has an ooh word, Romanov. It has that in there. So writers need to be very careful about what they title things.
Well, writers can learn a great deal from you about writing thrillers, because you are really the expert, and you are also a founder of the International Thriller Writers. International Writers?
International Thrill Writers. I'm a founding member. There was about, I don't know, 50 or 60 of us that were the original members of ITW. The organization was founded by Gail Lenz and David Morrell, who are the actual founders who created it. Then about 50 of us joined, and we became founding members. And I served as co-president for 3 years, and I served on the board for a long time, about 10, 12 years. So it's an organization that I had a lot to do with, and it's still going strong.
And exactly, you are the example par excellence of what people are looking for when they're looking for a thriller, a story that keeps you sort of hanging on with enough twists and turns. I know one of your members, Andrew Grant, once mentioned you as somebody who that, you know, he looked up to your writing, and it's just...
That's very nice. That's very nice for him to say. I like Andrew a lot. That's Lee Child's brother.
Yeah. Andrew is now Andrew Child.
Yes, that's right. He's actually writing them now. He's a fine writer. He's an excellent writer.
He is. And as a matter of fact, he and his wife were co-hosts on the program last year during the pandemic when I couldn't get into the studio. So they co-hosted Joy on Paper for me.
Well, that's very nice of them. That's great.
Yeah, that was great. I'm back in the studio now, but things are, you know, when we look at... Someone as you love history, did you ever imagine it could be we could have this? I mean, this never came up as a plot.
Well, I mean, you see thrillers all the time with pandemics and pathogens that do things, and I think we learned something. It's interesting in all those thrillers, the pathogen and the whatever happened, you know, was sort of a horrible thing that just wipes people out instantaneously, you know, across the board. We learned something in this pandemic. You actually don't have to do that. It can be a very slow, methodical thing. And in fact, the slow, methodical thing is worse in that regard. It's fascinating to see how the fiction and reality came together with that. I mean, the pandemic has been a horrible thing across the globe, but it, you know, in thrillers, we made it even worse. in some respects, so and quicker, where what's happening here is a very slow process that, you know, COVID-19 is not going anywhere. It's going to be here forever. We're going to have to learn to live with it and have to adapt to it. But eventually we'll get it back completely vaccinable and treatable, and it'll become something we can manage.
Well, you know, for you and your wife, Elizabeth, who I know you love to travel, and you so many of the places that are in your books you've traveled to and done research, this COVID-19 thing has put a damper on travel for sure.
No, none. We go nowhere in 20 or 21. We won't go on the road again until next year, 22 sometime. And that depends on how things go. So yes, it's kind of put an end to that. Luckily, I was a few books ahead, and I'd already done my work, so I'm okay. And as far as having to go anywhere, but by probably later part of next year, early 23, I probably need to make a few trips to get some things going. But as I said, hopefully by then we'll have things manageable where we can treat it and we can vaccine against it completely.
And get back on an airplane.
Yeah, and not have to wear a mask for 10 hours and get some semblance of normalcy back, but that's not going to happen in 21.
No,
I mean, the best we can hope for is 22.
Well, meanwhile, people can travel the world with you because in this book, of course, it takes place in quite a few different locations, including, of course, Europe, but also Africa, South America, and as you said, so many of your other books cover other areas of the world your books are really a perfect escape. One can read them, and it's funny. whatever problem in the world in your books, it doesn't seem as bad as what we're going through now. So it's sort of a release.
Well, that's the idea. I mean, I've made a conscious decision that COVID did not exist in Cotton's world. People deal with this every day. It's horrible. Every day we're having to deal with it. They certainly don't want to read about it, too. So my books are more of an escape. You can get into that world and go to some place where it doesn't exist. And in my novels, too, the locations become characters in the book. That's been way it's always been, and they my readers like that. They like going to those places. I keep it as close to reality as I possibly can. And in this book, you're going to go to South America, in southern Chile, southern Argentina, which has a fascinating history and a fascinating heritage that factors into what happened after World War II. Germans immigrated there by the thousands, and that was not by accident. There was a reason for that. And then South Africa had the same situation, and readers are going to get a full run of both of those. And that kind of lets your imagination run wild, and you travel vicariously.
Well, I think it's a great thing to do, and one, for you are so interested in history and also preserving history. Tell us a little bit about what you and your wife have been doing to preserve history.
Yeah, we have a foundation called History Matters. We help communities raise money for historic preservation. We go into a community. We usually teach a writer's workshop, a four-hour course on writing, where you buy your way in with a contribution, and all that money goes to the project. But we've done dinners and luncheons and galas, you name it. About 80-something projects. We've raised a little over $2 million for various projects around the country. And we'll be doing some more. We didn't do anything in 20 or 21, but we'll hopefully to get back in 22. Certainly by 23 we'll be back. But we hope to get going again next year. Anyone's interested in that, they can go to the website, steveberry.org, click on History Matters, and you can learn all about it and see some of the projects we've dealt with.
Well, are you going to be doing some Zoom classes for writers?
No, well, it works better in person.
Of course.
It's just it's much more an in-person type of thing. And if you Zoom it, it could, you don't want it recorded or anything, because then you can't do it again if it becomes that. You know, we teach a very intense 4 hours. We taught about 3,000 students about there, and we'll get back doing it again in 22, I hope. Certainly, as I said, by 23, we'll be back in. So we just have to find the right projects, because, see, we don't charge to go there. We pay our own way to go there. All the money that's raised goes to the project. There's no cost or expenses of anything, so we choose our projects very carefully.
Well, I do hope that they'll be back. As you said, in 2022, it's hard to believe what we've gone through this past year, and heading now into almost a full year since we started this thing.
That's right.
It's as somebody interested in history, it must really you look back on previous things like 1918, and you wonder just how we got here.
Well, it just shows us how fragile we are. We're not quite as you know, invincible as we think we are. Biology is tough, and you know, that virus has been around billions of years, and it's learned to survive, and it's very good at it. And we have to be smarter than that virus.
Well, one of the things I liked, I noticed, you used a quote by Voltaire, and I've been reading more and more of Voltaire during this past year. I don't know why I was drawn to it. So I love when authors use quotes, and that help people sort of think about, you know, where these quotes come from and why they're meaningful after all these years.
Yeah. I like those in there. I like the characters to think those things and put them in there, and I put them in there on purpose. They're there for a reason. Yes.
Yes, I that's what I was, you know, I realized that, and I thought, well, that's nice, because when people read something like that, they might just say, you know, well, who is this Voltaire guy? You know, and as Benjamin Franklin said, you know, without Voltaire, there might not have been, you know, the Revolutionary War. So it's fascinating when just sometimes just a word, a name, a quote can really move people to do some deeper thinking. And they will actually think about your book, too. I love that you have at the end, of course, you have your author's notes, and you explain in there what were facts and what, you know, things that you made up to tell the story. And again, I think those author's notes also will spur people on to do some more and deeper reading.
That's the idea. I want the reader to know what's real and what's not. I keep the books about 90% to reality, so I keep it close, and I tell you what's real so that you won't think something I made it up. And there are some reference points back there, and if you want to do some more reading, it's encouraged. And the only thing I will say is do not read the writer's note first. It will give away the entire novel.
Exactly.
It's designed. We put it in the back of the book for a reason. It's designed to read when you're done.
Exactly. And everybody, I just want to tell you that this great book is available. Kaiser's Web is available wherever books are sold. I don't know if there are bookstores, but definitely online. And get this book and have a little bit of escape from today's problems and get, well, maybe not all completely from today's problems.
Yeah. And they're all in stores, too. The books are in stores everywhere. You can pick it up in hardcover and all kinds of any format that you like. They're out there today. It's today's release day, and they can find out more about me and those books at my website, steveberry.org.
Okay, well, Steve, thank you so very much for being on Joy on Paper today. It's a joy to talk to you, and everyone, get this book. And then I love the Amber Room. I really love
thank
that
you.
Book. Okay, bye bye now, Steve.
Bye bye.
Bye. Okay, a little bit of Georgia there. You hear that Georgian accent? Very nice. He's a great guy. Okay, we're going to have a book buzz. And this one is very, very special because it is the February selection of just a wonderful author, Devon Miller, who is doing these book buzzes for us every single month. Here we go.
Hey everyone, this is Devon Miller, author and illustrator of the Mr. Tickety Talk Club children's book series, reporting for Joy on Paper with the latest on children's book buzz. It's that time of year, it's February, and that means love is in the air, and something that I myself love to do is draw. And that's what some of you guys are going to find yourself doing after reading this new book, Borders, written by children's literature enthusiast Chris Tomasi. In Chris's first published book, it's a book that asks the question, if kids were in charge of making the map of their country and or world, what would it look like? How would our world be redesigned? In an effort of attempting to understand the world we live in, Chris aims to inspire kids to reimagine our world for the better. Illustrated by Mark Breyer, the book encourages kids to go ahead, pick up some paper and pen, and draw the world as they imagine it. As a kid at heart who loves to draw, I think you'll find me drawing the world the way I imagine it too. This is Devon Miller reporting for Joy on Paper. For more book buzz involving children's books and authors, head on over to radio-joyonpaper.com and click on Devon Miller's Book Buzzes. I think it's about time that I buzz out now.
This is the TAN Talk Radio Network.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more recording careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com.
Have you ever faced disaster? The Red Cross is always there for you. The Red Cross responds to a call for help every 8 seconds. They have never turned anyone down. Now they need your financial support so that they can be ready to help you when the need arises. Donate online at redcross.org. Thank you.
This is the TAN Talk Radio Network.
Patsy with a Z, and I am back, and I am just waiting for my next guest to call in, and he is Chris Tomasi, and the subject of Devon Miller's little book buzz that we just played for you. And I, again, want to thank Devon so much for doing these book buzzes, and to remind all of you that his books are available online. You could go to Amazon, and the books are Mr. Tickety Talk Clock Books, and he has five of them right now. I think he's probably working on more. I'm sure 100 books from now, he will still be going with Mr. Tickety Talk Clock, because Mr. Tickety Talk Clock is clever. When I look back on my school days, and I spent a lot of time looking at that clock on the wall, because I was always, I was actually eager to get out of class, and I never in my life thought about turning that clock into a character. And so that's why I'm always so thrilled when I think of Devon and that he got this brilliant idea. You know, how many millions of kids have stared at that clock and nobody ever thought of turning it into a major book series? So he's quite a guy, and I'm really thrilled that he's become part of the Joy on Paper family, along with Rita Moreau. Hello, Rita, out there. I hope you're doing well. She's getting tired of being stuck in the house. And, of course, also to Carol J. Perry. I want to say hello, a special hello to her, because I love her Witch City Mysteries. And I've been thinking a lot about her. She's going to be on May 25th with her next book. And so I'm just, it's really exciting to think about that, because she was the first guest in the studio. Right now, I haven't had very many guests in the studio. Devon was a guest, but really, you know, we're trying to keep it to a minimum. And I'm hoping by the end of May, Carol will actually be able to join me here in the studio so we can celebrate this newest book. And I just see Ed smiling, and he's happy because I think Chris Tomasi has called in, and I've been looking forward to talking to him because it's a subject that really has always interested me. So I was really thrilled when Devon recommended this book as his second pick for the year, February. We're looking forward to his March selection, and I think he's just about ready to come on the air. So I'm just looking at Big Ed over there in the control room, and we'll see in a minute, and hopefully have a chance to talk about this wonderful book called Borders. Meanwhile, also, I just wanted to remind everyone, people have been sending me messages for Bill Larson. He's going to be on the program on Thursday. Send me your questions. You can go to my webpage, and I will be happy to ask Bill Larson your intellectual property questions. But meanwhile, now I can turn to Chris Tomasi. I am so happy to welcome you to the program, Chris.
Hey, Patsy. Thank you so much for having me. I'm really overjoyed to be here. So thank you so much.
Well, you know, when Devon selected your book as his second pick for the year, I was so thrilled because I was a homeschool mom. And I was also a world traveler, so I love maps. I have a trunk full of maps. And when I got this book, I just
thought, they're the best.
Oh, maps. I love maps. So tell us about Borders and how you got the idea for it. Beautifully illustrated by Mark Breyer, and the entire project behind Borders.
Absolutely. Well, first of all, thanks to Devon for finding Borders out there in the world and bringing it to your attention. Super grateful that he did just that. And if you think about the story itself, it really asks the question, you know, what if kids were in charge of making the map? And that idea came to me while channeling some childlike curiosity myself, actually on a cross-country flight. I was looking at the flight map in front of me and just thinking about the borders I saw in the U.S. and around the world and really trying to figure out how they came to be the way that they are. And through the simple premise of thinking through that childlike lens, created that first draft of Borders and playfully explored the invisible lines that define our states, countries, and continents, and really challenged readers to think outside of the way it's always been and reimagine our world for the better. So that's ultimately what led us to creating this book by Borders and bringing it out into the world.
Well, of course, tell us about your interest. Now, you graduated from Amherst with an English degree. Tell us how you got involved in children's books and in just being interested in children's books.
Yeah, I've always been fond of children's literature. Growing up, I can still recount some of the classics that I read as a kid. And, when I headed to Amherst College, I had this idea that I needed to, if I needed to be in business someday, I needed a major in economics or something of that degree. Because there's three main defined tracks at Amherst, right? There's law, there's finance, there's medical. And I didn't really fit on any of those tracks. And it wasn't until my sophomore year where I really listened to my heart and decided to get back into some things that I cared about deeply with writing and poetry. And during that time, I met a professor there named Karen Sanchez Epler, who is one of the professors that I dedicated the story to, who did a lot of work with archival children's literature. And we had an amazing archives in the Amherst College Frost Library, where I spent an entire summer working with a unique 18th century collection of children's works and creating a website on that. And from there, combined with my study of poetry, really just allowed me to kind of explore that world a bit further and dive right in.
Well, it is wonderful when you have a mentor, somebody who has a passion for a subject that you have a passion for.
Yeah, no, it certainly was. And Karen certainly ignited that for me. And I also had the pleasure of working alongside the poet in residence at the time, Daniel Hall. And I actually wrote a manuscript for a children's book called Offline, and I did not pursue that one for publishing at this point, but not too long after graduation, it's all that they had taught me, was able to come up with Borders and ultimately bring it to life with the help of Mark Breyer, who, as you mentioned, did an amazing job.
Well, his illustrations are fantastic. And when you were doing your research into old children's books, what were some of the things that you discovered?
I think my biggest takeaway was that a child's imagination transcends all centuries, and individuals really love to make sense of this world in their own creative ways. So the specific juvenilia that we were working with, it was actually by these brothers who lived in Goshen, New Hampshire in the 18th century. They were the Nelson brothers. And what was so special, we found their collection of handmade books actually in an auction. Someone at the college had gone to an auction, found this book. She thought it was just a bunch of little illustrations. But what we discovered was actually that the Nelson brothers had created this whole imaginary world and really created a historical account of rural New Hampshire during that period of time and kept it all together in their own collection. And they would play, and during the time of ongoing wars at the time, they would replicate those warlike atmospheres in their backyard, in the woods, and creating forts and recounting this with imaginary characters in their own creative ways. And that, to me, just really, in this technological world that we live in, where I think artificial forms of entertainment are quite dominant, I think it's so special that children can hold on to that idea that they can use their own creativity and imagination to create worlds of their own, and hopefully kind of never lose touch of that initial spark that has existed for so many years.
Well, one of the wonderful things that you've done, you have on your website a project, Making the Map. Tell us about that.
Yep. Absolutely. So if you were to go to my website, christomasi.com, you would see part of the website actually leads you to an exercise that we call Making the Map. And if you were to share it on social media, whether it's Instagram or Twitter, hashtag Making the Map, you'll see some other creations that kids have come up with. And essentially what it is at the end of the story, there's a call to action. It says, go ahead. I'm tired of asking who, what, and why. Pick up your pen and give it a try. And it's really a call to action for individual readers and young children to reimagine our world for the better in their own creative ways. So what you can do as a parent, like yourself, Patsy, who was homeschooling back in the day, and which has become so common today in our pandemic world, or if you're actually in a classroom and doing hybrid learning, you can print out a blank outline of the United States, North America, Europe, Asia, Australia, whatever continent that you would like to explore, and have children just redraw the lines as they imagine it. And what we've seen with such little direction, kids have come up with some really creative and zany content. And the best part is there's no right answers to this exercise, and you get to really let creativity take the wheel. And it's been so special seeing what kids have come up with. People have tagged me on Instagram and sent me emails with photos of them making the map, and I even have some printed out in my office space just to serve as inspiration for many of the conversations and activities that the book has inspired.
And I have looked at some of them, and I just found it delightful. The children have colored the maps, and they've come out with names for states or locations, and it's so cute. It's such a wonderful project.
Yeah, it's been pretty impressive to see what they come up with, whether it's Pizza Plaza or Giraffe Land, Melted Ice Cream Island. Even some creative visual representations of the ways that the outline of the U.S. looks, like up in New England, young children have turned that into a dog, the shape of a dog. And, Wisconsin, they've changed the long stretch of Wisconsin over Michigan into an evil witch nose. It's just been, or a rhino in some cases. So it's just been super cool to see them, reimagine our world. And ultimately, these are going to be our future leaders. So hopefully there's a message instilled in there that kids are really, you know, can go on to do some pretty special things and put their mind to, you know, solving big problems.
Well, one of my favorite books when I was a kid is a 1906 geography book that my grandfather had. It was the first, and I actually think perhaps the only book that he ever bought when he came to America, and he wanted to learn about America. And it's a beautiful, it's a very large book, beautiful maps, and I go to that quite often, and it's quite funny. After, you know, the Soviet Union broke up and other countries broke up, many of those countries that sort of disappeared for years are back, and they're in that 1906 geography book. I loved maps then. I think it's one of the reasons I really became a world traveler. I traveled all over the place, and when I homeschooled, a history lesson was not complete without a map. I mean, we mapped Napoleon's battles. We mapped, you know, everything. And really, it opens a map, can open a mind to so many things. So you're learning words, you're learning places, and then hopefully you add some history in there as you go along. So I think this is a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful book.
Yeah, no, I appreciate it. And hopefully classrooms use this as a point of jumping off for those conversations and to actually come up with the literal answers, but also juxtapose that with the playfulness that the book allows. So I'm right there with you.
Yeah.
I love maps. And you'd mentioned immigrating over to the U.S. Where was your father coming in from?
Well, from Finland, grandfather, Finland.
Oh, amazing.
As a matter of fact, that nose, that witch nose, the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, that's where he went. And that's where my family, you know, we lived. It's called the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. We're Youpers. And when he arrived at Ellis Island, they offered him two choices. They said, you can have, there was a thing at the time, he could get 40 acres in St. Petersburg, Florida, or 40 acres in northern Michigan. Now, my father was against the Russians, and there was no way he was going to come to St. Petersburg and take 40 acres. So he went to northern Michigan, and we still have those 40 acres. And if he had had not hated the Russians so much, I would have had 40 acres here in St. Petersburg, where I live. Can you imagine?
Oh, you ended up there.
Can you imagine?
The reason I ask is my grandfather, too, immigrated from Italy through Ellis Island. So we have that in common, and I think it's an important reminder of some of the amazing things that you know, our diverse population can accomplish. So kudos to him, and I'm glad you still have that 40 acres.
Well, we do. We still have it has perhaps the same value today as it had then. I wouldn't even begin to imagine what 40 acres here in Florida would be worth. I mean, like $1 zillion. But we enjoyed it. What the heck? We enjoyed it. And he was also afraid of bugs because they said it in Florida it's hot, and he didn't, you know, in Finland they don't have big bugs. So he was happy. What the heck, you know? And it worked out fine. Here I am in Florida. I don't know. Where are you? Where do you live?
I'm in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, currently.
Okay, so you've been going through the cold spells up there?
Yeah. I was born, I grew up in the Boston area. So I've been hardened by many winters and unfazed.
Okay, because we had like 3 weeks of cold weather. It was like in the 50s. We were all going crazy down here. And so I sort of laugh at that, because for you, that's springtime. But anyway, it's wonderful that you have done this book. I think that I assume you're coming out with more children's books.
I hope so. We'll see when inspiration strikes next, but so grateful that, you know, after launching just in January, there's almost 800 copies out there in the world, and children responding so well, both young and old, and even adults are, you know, having conversations around the dinner table that I think are so important. So I would certainly love to publish my next book, and what that looks like, I'm not sure.
So,
but
have you
this one in the meantime.
Have you joined some of the homeschool network groups? Because I used to belong to all of them, and I know all the homeschoolers will just love this book, and definitely of all the, you know, I don't know what schools are open anymore, but all the teachers out there, somehow you have to connect and really get things moving, because this is a great book for kids, and kids need this right now. They need something fun. They need something that, you know, parents will just, for example, I love Giraffe Land. I love giraffes. So when I saw the Giraffe Land one, I said, yeah, because I have a 10-foot giraffe outside my front door. So, you know, it's a name that I would pick. So I think you've done a beautiful job, Chris Tomasi, with this. Again, repeat your webpage for people.
So you can check out and learn more at www.ChrisTomasi.com. So it's ChrisTamasi. And we're available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Books A Million. So there's some other options for you to get a book as soon as possible. But I hope you enjoy it. Certainly reach out, connect with me on Instagram and Twitter. And excited to connect with all of you. And thank you, Patsy, for having me. This has been such a pleasure.
Well, it's been a joy to talk to you. And I, again, want to thank Devon for bringing you to my attention. And I will continue to promote this book over the entire year. As I told you, we played this book buzz, and we will play it many times over the year to make sure that people hear about you and get your wonderful book.
Awesome. Well, I'm excited to see the ways that all of your listeners, are making the math and continue to imagine our world in new and creative ways.
Okay. Well, Chris Tomasi, make sure that when you do publish the next book, you let me know, and you'll be back here on Joy on Paper so we can talk about it some more.
Perfect. Okay. Well, Patsy, have a great rest of your week, and thanks to everyone for listening in.
Okay. Bye-bye now, Chris. Bye.
All right. Take care.
Okay. Well, he's such a nice guy. Oh, and you can go to his website. You can find out more about him. And if you do Instagram and Twitter, you can see that too. And see those. I love them. The kids have done. There's a Pink Land. There's all sorts of wonderful, wonderful projects that the kids have done. Color different countries, different states. It's really nice. A very, very thoughtful and intelligent book, and one that is beautifully illustrated and well worth your time and money. Because if you know any child, and I really feel so sad for all the kids who have been stuck in the house, and it's just, it's almost overwhelming just to even think about it. But a book like this will be really well received, and something that will give them many projects. It's not a book that you'll just read one time. A parent can read the book with the child, but the projects go on. And as Chris mentioned, the maps are available on his website, and his last name is Tomasi, Tamasi. It's real easy, Tomasi, a really pretty name, Italian name, and I like that name. I've never seen that name before. I love when I find a name that I, one great name for a character in a book. Anyway, visit his website and get his book, and let's get his sales up. He deserves it, because he's been thinking about kids and about how he can help. And just like Devon Miller thinks about kids, cares about kids reading, and that's the important thing in life, to think about other people. And in these times where everybody is struggling and confused and don't know what they're doing half the time, to have books that, first of all, the books for kids that really help them to expand their imaginations, give them something to think about other than, you know, wearing a mask, it's really, writers do such a service to people by writing. This is what people forget. You have to really, really thank all the people who take the time and the effort to write, because it's not easy. And sometimes it breaks my heart when I think about the struggles that authors have to go through today, particularly. They have, like Steve Barry, now he sold 25 million books, 25 million with 6 zeros. Really? I mean, he's got a lot of books out there. But even he, you know, he doesn't have a lot of opportunity to do his promotions like he would in the past. There are no book tours, there are no book conventions, there are no writers' events. And so it is very, very difficult. And people go through all of this hard work to write a book, promote a book, and they deserve our support. So please buy a book. And then make sure on Thursday that you are here with me, because I have a very special, very special treat. Nicholas Guy Smith, who narrated the wonderful, wonderful book, The Gentleman in Moscow, A Gentleman in Moscow. Nick is going to be here, and we are going to be talking about Keats and about some other poets, because I asked him to join me, I just want to listen to his voice again. I could have him on every week because I love Nick's voice. He's an absolutely amazing narrator, award-winning narrator. I have listened to A Gentleman in Moscow at least three, four times. I don't know. I often play it I can listen to Nick's voice and fall asleep, and it's very nice. As I said to Nick once, he's the only other man that I've ever slept with, because I will put his book on and I will listen to him and fall asleep because I love his voice. So he's going to be here on Thursday, and we're going to talk about what he's been up to. He's won some awards. He's a fantastic author. And of course, we're going to talk about Keats and one of the saddest things a writer has ever written is what Keats wrote. And I want to talk about that on Thursday, because it just breaks your heart. You want to just start crying. And I won't say it now, because I will start crying, and I don't want to start crying. I've got lots of things to do today. I don't have time to stop and cry. But join me on Thursday for that. And also a special shout out again to George. I hope you're feeling better. But there it is. There's the music, and it's putting it on for me, and so that I can say, remember, one, I don't know, remember a lot of things. One of the joys of life is to see your words on paper, or to hear them spoken in an audible book, or if you're lucky, to hear those magic words, lights, camera, action, and your book will be turned into a major motion picture, streaming video, or perhaps a series on the Hallmark Channel. You never know, and you won't know if you don't start writing. So start writing today, like Carol J. Perry, who has written a wonderful series called Witch City Mysteries, and they are fantastic, and she's going to be here at the end of May to talk about them. So just get to work on it. And meanwhile, say something nice to somebody. I will say something nice to Bigette in the control room. Thank you, Ed, for everything. Oh, he's saluting me. I'm saluting him, because I got this big, big load of books today, and he had to carry it all in. Anyway, thank you, Ed, and thank you all. Join me on Thursday. It's going to be a fun, fun day. Bye-bye.
WTAN Clearwater
FM 106.1
WDCF Dade City
FM 102.3
WZHR Zephyr Hills
FM 104.3
Listen.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by Rocket Mortgage. I'm Steve.